I'm Jane Crowell, the editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
Hello, boys. This week, we are assessing award winner Nomadland, Angelina Jolie's thriller Those Who Wish Me Dead, another awards winner Sound of Metal, and horror redux Spiral. But before we start with those, what have you guys been watching this week? Jordan, what have you been sticking your eyes on?
I've been catching up on some Apple TV Plus shows, which I do once every 6 months or so at the moment. Watched the first couple of episodes of Mythic Quest season 2, which were very fun. I like that show a lot. I watched Trying season 2, which is out shortly.
Oh yeah, good.
And I can talk about now. Very enjoyable show. I didn't quite enjoy the second season as much as the first, but still a good time. And the only time I can recall watching Rafe Spall in something where I've actually liked a character he plays, because I usually loathe every character he plays. And I also watched all 10 episodes of a show called Home Before Dark, which stars Brooklyn Prince, the brilliant young girl from The Florida Project. Mm-hmm. She plays this 9-year-old investigative journalist who moved
which
back
is how we all feel
hometown.
Inside, right?
exactly. So the family moves back to the father's hometown where this boy went missing 30 years prior, and she sets out trying to solve the mystery. So it's essentially Mayor of Easttown style small town murder mystery, just with this precocious 9-year-old girl as the main character. So it's tons of fun.
That love sounds it. Absolutely awesome, and I love them in Florida Project, so I'm straight onto that.
What have you been watching, Jamie?
I've been watching a couple of shows like Mayor of Easttown as it drops each week, and Girlfriend Experience season 3 and stuff like that, and keeping up to date with, you know, weekly films and new releases. But my main watch at the moment, which I'm absolutely obsessed with, is I'm returning to all the 80s and 90s action movies. I just can't get enough.
Why?
Of them. It's been 13 months or something of lockdown. I think I'm going a bit mental. It's a nostalgia hit. It's turn your brain off to watch an action movie, easy watching in these hard times. And basically, I started off with Steven Seagal, but I watched all of his first movies up to Under Siege. So I did Hard to Kill, Out for Justice, Mark for Death, Above the Law, Under Siege. Then I did all of Van Damme's early work again, Bloodsport, Cyborg, AWOL, Time Cop, Nowhere to Run. Then I went on to Chuck Norris, then Harrison Ford, then a bit of Arnie and Sly. So it's not the last week, it's the last kind of month, but I seriously think I've watched about 40 80s and 90s action movies in the last month on top of everything else. And I'm going to watch some more tonight. I just can't wait.
I do habitually watch Hard Target. I do love that.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. Load me and tell your girlfriend to point her titties north and step on the gas. Like that guy. What kind of henchman are you? And the hair on Van Damme is just great, isn't it?
I was going to say Hard Target. I mean, Van Damme, I'm doing them chronological. So I'm starting, you know, right at the beginning of Van Damme. And you get to a sudden point about 6 movies in when he starts growing his mullet. And then Hard Target is just...
It's peak mullet.
Peak mullet. It's just one of the greatest mullets in movies.
He's like Samson. He just got more powerful as his hair got longer.
Mm. He really did.
And the waist of his jeans got higher. it's a great film.
And the angle of his splits got bigger.
And more and more splits. In Time Cop, he does the splits about 7 times. I mean, by that point, it's his signature moves. So it's like, right, 10 minutes has gone. Time for the splits again.
I haven't been watching anything so fun. I've been watching the Son of Sam documentary on Netflix and scaring myself about the links to satanic rituals and Scientology. My final episode to watch tonight, so maybe this is all going to be pulled like a rug from under me. But at the moment, it's incredibly creepy. And again, it reminded me of how much I love Summer of Sam, the Spike Lee film. And, Adrian Brody, when he wasn't just a guy that went on yachts in Cannes and did parties, but actually did acting, and Jennifer Esposito, just fabulous in that.
John Leguizamo, one of his best performances. He's amazing in that.
So I think I might revisit that when I finish watching this horrific miniseries. Okay, shall we have a look at what we can watch then this week at the cinema? Are you ready to travel vicariously with this?
You are one of those lucky people that can travel anywhere.
Yes, ma'am.
And they sometimes call you nomads.
My mom said that you're homeless. Is that true?
No, I'm not homeless. I'm just houseless. Not the same thing, right?
No.
My husband worked at the USG mine in Empire. I was a substitute teacher.
It is a tough time right now. You may want to consider early retirement.
I need work. I like work.
So this is Nomadland. The awards winner, Chloe Zhao, got an award. Frances McDormand got an award. The film was awarded. Jamie, quick recap. What is it actually about?
It's set after the kind of 2008 crash that this really has on in America, that a lot of people lost their homes or couldn't afford their homes and started to live in camper vans going around America, kind of roaming the countryside. And this follows Fern, played by Frances McDormand, who's a 60-something widow. She lives in Empire, Nevada, which is a town that is completely wiped off the map by the 2008 crash. So she gets in her camper van and starts going about the countryside, and she meets various other people, various other nomads. This is how they live. And that's it, really. But it's just her kind of recalibrating her life, kind of finding the pioneer spirit in a way, that in a way it's really beautiful and poetic, and you've got all the rugged landscapes and a sense of freedom and liberation. It's got a sort of nobility to it. But on the other hand, it's obviously a life full of hardship, heartache. You know, the vans break down, people's bodies break down, because the people doing this tend to be in their 60s, 70s, in the twilight of life. And it's just a film where it's not heavily plot based. It's kind of just roaming around, meeting people, talking to people, sharing life experiences. There's a hint of a romantic subplot when she bumps into a guy played by David Strathairn. Will they get together? Will they not? In a Hollywood film, you know which way it would go, but this is very much its own thing. And I have to say, you know, it deserved that Best Picture. It is a wonderful, wonderful film.
Yeah. And Frances McDormand deserves an Oscar for pooing in a bucket very enigmatically.
Yes. She does, quite near the start of a film.
And that's the level that this film is at. There's no fancy pants, airs and graces, is it? This is, as you say, rugged. This is about, you know, having to have food poisoning in the back of a van. What do? You are pooing in a bucket. If your van breaks down, you could die in the desert if you haven't got a spare wheel. If you don't get the job you need that you're searching for, then how will you make it through the winter? These are people sort of living a sort of great lives, but very precarious lives, aren't they? Jordan, what did you think of it?
I think it's just a wonderful film. I've watched it a couple of times now. Just a hugely empathetic film about people who have chosen to live these lives outside societal norms for a whole host of reasons. Obviously, we've spoken about this film on the podcast before. The reason why we're talking about it now is because cinemas are reopening, and now is your opportunity to actually go and see it in a cinema, which I would highly recommend, because this is just a gorgeous, gorgeous film to look at. Beautifully shot by Zhao and her cinematographer, Joshua James Richards, all, you know, magic hour, sunlit beauty. It's really, really quite something to look at. But even if you can't make it to a cinema, or, you know, you're not ready to go back yet, you can watch it on Disney Plus now for no additional cost if you have a subscription. And even that is just a completely magical experience. As far as I'm concerned, I think it's a really impressive piece of work. Really builds on what Chloe Zhao is doing with The Rider, the under the fingernails kind of grit. Like, it feels really authentic and truthful to these people's experiences. And I absolutely can't wait to see what she's going to do with a monster budget over at Marvel.
We had a cat last week. We got a dog this week. I think Jean was agreeing with you, Jordan, that, you know, Chloe Zhao.
Wholehearted agreement.
It with a Marvel budget. But also, I think what's going to be really nice to see with what she does with that is, as you said the word empathy there. She just really brings human kindness to the screen with her films so far, and a real understanding of people and what makes each individual tick. In Nomadland, you really do get to understand what makes Swanky tick, this woman she meets on the road, or what forces Fern to reject a lovely warm bed in a nice house and go back in the van. You really get it. And so it would be really nice to see what characterization and empathy and kindness she brings to a Marvel universe.
One of the things I loved about it, which you just touched upon, is that kindness. Because the first time I watched it, like Jordan, I've seen it a couple of times. And the first time I watched it, the whole film, I kind of expected at some point for a biker gang to ride up and for there to be a massive conflict or some sort of, you know, the material world really screws them over and it's horrible. And it doesn't have that. It's just got lovely, gentle rhythms and people are compassionate and treat each other nicely all through. But having said that, it's not soppy and sentimental. Things do go wrong and it's a very hard life. It just gets that balance just right. It's great. And Frances McDormand, it's her third Oscar. And for me, it's her best performance to date, which is really saying something. It's just kind of completely stripped back, unadorned. She's got this closely cropped haircut, no makeup, just nothing flash. It's just really back to basics and just very believable, very authentic. It's just great.
Yeah. But do see it in the cinemas because, as you said, it's gorgeous to look at. And also the soundtrack is lovely. It's just such an immersive, lovely experience. We can go back in the cinemas, but we can't really travel that far right now. But this film really does take you somewhere different, doesn't it? And puts you in the place that of each of her stops. You really get a sense of Badlands and camping there and what that would be like, or traveling to Nebraska in the winter, which I'm not sure I do want to go and pick beets in Nebraska. That did look quite cold and miserable. But, you know, it really does give you that sense of travel. And whilst we're all sort of desperate to get away at the moment, this might be the way to do it.
Yeah, those multiple Oscars were well-deserved. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress. The Academy got it absolutely right with this film.
Yeah. Go and give the cinemas your money. That is Nomadland, and it is out from Monday the 17th. Off you go and see it on a big screen. Okay, so from Fran to Ange, shall we see what Miss Jolie is up to with this?
My dad said if anything happened, I should find someone I could trust. Are you someone I can trust?
We promise absolutes. Act accordingly.
Run on. Run on. Those men that came for your father. Did you see their faces? That's them. Tell them that God's gonna cut you down.
Run! Give me something else to worry about.
Those who wish me dead. Jordan. Who wishes who dead? What's Angelina Jolie doing in this?
Well, that's the question. This is the latest film from Taylor Sheridan, writer of Sicario, Hell or High Water, and the writer-director of Wind River. It stars Ange, as you say, as Hannah. She's a daredevil skydiver who fights forest fires.
She's
in the
a
wilderness
smoke jumper, Jordan. That's what they're
a
called.
Smoke jumper, that's what they're called. She's a smoke jumper who fights forest fires in the wilderness of Montana for a living. She's living with the trauma of this forest fire, which she sort of incorrectly predicted the spread of, which resulted in numerous avoidable deaths. And she's been put on firewatch duty because of this failed psychological evaluation that happened in the wake of that event. Meanwhile, two assassins, played by Aidan Gillen and Nicholas Holt, are on this mission to kill a lawyer who has unearthed damning evidence. As to what, we're not entirely sure, but that's not really important. The lawyer catches wind of this and jumps in a car and with his young son and drives to Montana because his sheriff brother, played by John Bernthal, lives there with his pregnant wife. And after a run-in with these hitmen, the boy, Connor, played by Finn Little, escapes into the wilderness where he's found by Hannah, who chooses to help the boy to safety as he's pursued by these hitmen. All the while, a man-made forest fire rages around them, which is quite a complicated setup for what is a fairly simple, and I have to say, despite the raging infernos throughout, a film that left me a little cold. Sheridan, he was brought on to rewrite the scripts and only signed on as director when another filmmaker dropped out. And I think you can tell because this felt a great deal more generic than any of his previous work to me. Certainly Wind River and Hell or High Water, which I thought are both terrific films. But this film, it just felt like it didn't have any of the fingerprints of those films all over it. You know, there's a sort of dusty authenticity to the action in his previous work. And here, with a few sort of different choices, I could see this you know, being some generic Liam Neeson action vehicle directed by Olivier Megaton. It just felt like there was nothing unique or different to it. I don't think Angelina gets anywhere near enough to do in the film. She's set up as this daredevil smoke jumper, as we say, who, you know, near the start of the film, she sort of opens a parachute while speeding down the road on the back of a truck. But then there's no real payoff for this daredevil side to her later. She's barely even the main character in the film. John Bernthal, who plays the sheriff's deputy, Ethan, and Medina Senghore, who plays his pregnant wife, Allison, they have a much more integral role to play in the story and much better rounded sort of character arcs. Allison essentially occupies the kind of badass role that you expect Angelina's Hannah to occupy, which is great because I really liked her character, but it did stress me out because she's a woman who's 6 months pregnant. So that was a bit unusual, a slightly unusual choice to sort of almost sideline Angelina in her own film. I don't know. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I thought it was just weirdly dated. It felt like something you'd watch from 10 years ago. As you say, you could imagine Liam Neeson being in it, or, you know, Pierce Brosnan or someone. And just like the lack of care to detail. That's the thing that I love about Hell and High Water and Wind River, is the specifics of those films and the sort of detail and the characterization. And we don't know what the actual thing is that the lawyers uncovered, who it's against, who it's going to bring down. And yet the two guys that are behind this kid trying to find him and kill him are sort of like T-1000 model assassins. Like, they are unstoppable, weird people. We don't know anything about why are they so keen to complete their mission, like when they're in the middle of fire and horribly burnt at one point. What's Angelina Jolie's character do? Why does she have that wig and that hair? Why would a smoke jumper have that much hair and not tie it back? When I'm thinking about these sort of things in a film, I know that somebody else hasn't done the thinking for me, because I'm actually wandering within it. Like, why is that happening? Why wouldn't they do that? You know, why does the dad do a certain thing when a car has crashed? Why didn't he just play dead? Things that annoy you when you're watching it mean that it hasn't had, I don't think, enough love and work put into it. What did you think, Jamie?
I thought it was hugely underwhelming and disappointing. Generic is a very good term for it. I think you've both used that word, and that says it all. And it's got certain things where you can see that Taylor Sheridan touch, like the way the assassins handle their weapons. You know, it's like in a Michael Mann movie, that it's really believable, you know, the way they load, lock and load, and the rugged, beautiful landscapes that are sort of dangerously beautiful, you know, they're really harsh in some ways. You know, you can see that in all his other films, and it wants to be like those other films, that it wants to be a lean, mean action thriller, but it just doesn't work. It doesn't hang together, and there's just far too many components to it. I mean, Jordan, I think, did a great job of summing up the plot earlier, but even though he did a great job, it took about 5 minutes to sum up the plot earlier, because there's about 12 different things going on that, until they all sort of click together, and some of them don't feel like they belong together or should click together. And, you know, all of a raging fire, for example, to me that was just an attempt to sort of up the ante a bit and get a bit more action in there. And like Jordan said, that left me really cold as well, but it just all felt overcooked, if we're going to use another horrible pun. But, you know, if you want that, I never miss a chance to give a shout out to Only the Brave, which came out a few years ago and got pretty bad reviews and kind of went under the radar, but I think it's a really underrated film. And, you know, if you want to see people fighting forest fires, go and see Only the Brave. It's more real. It's more sort of serious and hits you in the gut. It's a much better character drama. Overall with this, I just came out the other end savagely disappointed. I really wanted to like it. I liked Taylor Sheridan's work up until this point a lot, but this is a fumble.
Yeah, I mean, and also, you know, kudos to the fact that, you know, one of the heroes of this, saving the child in the forest, is a woman, and one of the people who comes to rescue everybody with a shotgun is a woman. That's nice to see. That's shaken that up a bit. But I just didn't know that Angelina was being her best self. She was putting on Ray-Bans to denote characterization, and, you know, calling a kid buddy seemed to be at the limit of that sort of relationship they had together. It didn't hang together. It felt inauthentic and, like, I don't know, something like Dante's Peak or something, didn't it?
Yeah.
That sort of level, which, you know, Jamie, whilst you're rewatching all the action movies, maybe you'll get to that level and this would sit nicely within your rewatch.
Yes. If I get to Dante's Peak, I'm getting desperate.
Yeah. So so I think we're probably saying it's not necessarily worth your pennies to go and see at the cinema.
No. The film it reminded me of, which is most unfortunate to be compared to this film, but because it's got those two unstoppable killers, you know, which you said earlier, Jane, unstoppable killers, it reminded me a little bit of No Country for Old Men, but kind of moving through these really harsh terrains and this killer who can't be stopped behind you. And, you know, it's unfair to compare it to that because that film is a masterpiece, but this is just awful compared to that.
It's a real waste of John Bernthal, who I just think is great in everything and is good value in this, but deserves a much better film around him.
So maybe this is one that, you know, we're also saying do rush back to the cinemas. Maybe this is one, don't save that for home viewing. Put your money into Nomadland if you want to see some beautiful American scenery. And also this wasn't filmed in Montana, all filmed in New Mexico. So it's not even Montana scenery. So that is...
It's all a lie.
Things in films are a lie. Discuss.
What?
I know. So shall we move on to another line? Alternative line reading. It's time for Jamie to test our geek knowledge with what line he's reading in a different style. Jamie, go for it.
My line is actually two lines because it's two characters. One person says something and the other one responds to them. So here we go. Are you ready?
Yes.
I'm Candy. Of course you are. There you go.
I am Candy. God. Of course you are. Oh, it's so familiar. Obviously not in the way that you've delivered it, but it is so familiar. What is that?
Jamie's alternative reading was so good. It's completely thrown me off and I have no idea what it is.
I'm waiting for my call up to be a film actor with fine deliveries like that.
So this is a woman saying, I'm Candy, and it's a man responding with, of course you are. So I'm trying to think of characters called Candy.
I'll give you a little clue that another line from the male in the film, which I'm going to do roughly in his own voice or an impression of his voice to give you a clue.
Go on then, because we need it on this.
Hello, pretty.
That's no easier. Is this Highlander again?
It is Highlander.
Yeah.
It is.
Oh, of course it is.
It's when the Kurgan turns up and the prostitute is in the room. He's cleaning his sword, no pun intended, but he's cleaning his sword and then she's framed in the doorway and she says, hi, I'm Candy. And he, without even looking around, just carries on cleaning his sword and says, of course you are.
Hi, I'm Candy.
Of course you are.
I see what you did there. You swapped them over. Excellent. Well done, Jamie. I think that's the most entertaining one we've done so far. I think I'm going to give myself a gold star for getting that because I really was going down a Boogie Nights or something road with that. But Jamie, you probably should do, for everybody listening, your Forgive Me, Father, I Am But a Worm, because this is something that you generally howl in the office when we're all together. And as we're going to be getting back in the office soon, this is what we got to look forward to.
Okay, this is when he walks into the church and causes all sorts of chaos in the last place you should, God's house. Are you ready?
Yes.
Forgive me, Father. I am but a worm. Sorry, my West Country accent came out in the last bit. But...
Yes, it was a bit. Oh, forgive me, Father.
Wurzel Gummidge.
I am but a worm.
Okay. Right.
You like the Kurgan on this podcast.
I do. I love the Kurgan.
Okay. Well, shall we move on? It's time to get used to some silence after that, I think. Let's have a look at this.
Your hearing is deteriorating rapidly.
We'll come back. Till then, Lou, we just keep going, okay?
No.
Lou, no. Let's play tomorrow. Let's see what it's like, okay? I'm going to be like a click track. You can play to me.
Do you understand me? I can't. I'm deaf. I'm deaf.
So this is Sound of Metal, another Gong winner, starring Riz Ahmed. What's going on in this one?
Well, Riz Ahmed plays Ruben Stone, who is a drummer in a band. It's just him and his girlfriend. She's like guitarist and vocalist Lou, played by Olivia Cooke. And they're touring America. They're kind of this sort of dissonant, noise-mongering rock group, at the risk of sounding like an old man in terms of trying to describe their music.
And I was going to say, anyways, it's the sort of thing you like, and there you are sort of describing it in terms of like a disapproving dad.
I did actually quite like the music. But they're touring America and they're just on the verge, you know, their feeling of kind of getting somewhere and maybe sort of breaking through and all of that. And then Ruben Stone, he starts to lose his hearing just out of nowhere, which obviously being in a band is an awful turn of events. And he starts to go and have various tests and it seems to be irreversible that he is going deaf. And then he has to learn to live with that. And that is basically what the film is about, that he goes away and he joins a community, a kind of rehab community, which is led by the actor Paul Racy, who's a great actor. He got a nomination Best Supporting Actor for this. Paul Racy's parents in real life were actually deaf, so he's a big part of the deaf community. He's fantastic in this. And he takes on Riz Ahmed's character and all of the frustration and the anguish and the rage that Riz Ahmed's character has as he basically loses his hearing, his livelihood, doesn't know which way to turn and has to get over that and has to kind of adapt to his new way of life.
And it won loads of awards.
It won Best Sound because it really does immerse you in the character in terms of what he can hear and what he can't hear and this sort of dissonant feedback. And it's a brilliant job, the sound in this whole film. And basically Riz Ahmed, when he first started acting this part, he wore kind of his deep earplugs deep in the canals of his ears so that he couldn't hear anything. He couldn't even hear his own voice because he was trying to immerse himself in the role so much. And he stopped doing that. But he did carry on only using American Sign Language to talk to the director and to talk to the deaf cast, because a lot of the cast members in this film are from the deaf community. He learned to drum for 6 months. You know, it's one of those roles where the actor really, really goes for it, hell for leather. I mean, I've always liked Riz Ahmed. We all have. He's a fantastic actor, but this is next level stuff.
Yeah.
He was nominated Best Actor. He didn't actually win, but he was nominated. The film won Best Sound, Best Editing. It was nominated Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor, Best Original Screenplay. And again, like Nomadland, the Academy got it right. They rarely do, but they got it right on this one. It deserves all the plaudits. It's one of the year's best, really strong film.
Yeah, I mean, in any other year, he probably would have got that Best Actor nod, don't you think?
Yeah, especially because in the last year, he's had this performance and Mogul Mowgli, which has a lot of similarities that he's playing a rapper who gets a debilitating illness. So again, you know, has to readapt his life. Both films are about identity. The Academy often vote like that. They don't just vote on the performance in front of them. They take other work into account. So I think the fact he's had two amazing performances this year, most years he would have won Best Actor. You know, you'd really think he'd be in with a very good shout.
I'm just going to beat the drum for cinemas again because, you know, this film's been out on Amazon Prime for a few weeks in the UK. Yeah. So there's a good chance that, you know, a lot of our listeners have already seen it. But actually seeing this in a cinema with exceptional sound is really the optimum way to experience this film, because the sound design is just so, so important to how immersive and how overwhelming this film can be in some of those moments. It's a film that actually shares something in common with Nomadland, I think, in that, again, it's a film that has a huge amount of empathy for people who go through profound difficulty. And it actually gives us a better understanding of what it must be like to live as a nomad or to suddenly lose your hearing. And I don't think a film has ever given me that experience to quite this extent before. Yeah, it's really, really exceptional stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can hear all of the different levels of sort of muted sound he can hear, even sort of the sounds within his own body they've managed to tape. It reminded me of, you know, when you come out of the swimming pool after a swimming lesson at school and you'd have water in the room and you'd be like for ages trying to tip your head, get that out. And that weird percolating noise where you're like, I can hear my own heartbeat and my own eyelids closing. I don't like that. All of that sort of discombobulation that he experiences is in there. And yeah, I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival in 2019 in a cinema with great sound. And to have that immersive experience, but also all surrounding you, coming from the back of the theatre and all around, just makes it amazing and so moving as well. You know, no spoilers, but there are moments when his hearing ebbs and flows in what he can and can't hear, and what that means to people, and that even though things aren't perfect, that certain levels of hearing make such a difference. Yeah, highly recommend seeing in the big screen and with the big sound. So from the sound of metal, there's another film that's in cinemas this week, and it hasn't been on any streaming platforms. It's coming straight to the big screen. Shall we return to the scene of the crime with this?
Jigsaw? Wait, I thought the Jigsaw killer was dead.
He is.
Find him. They're hours, not days.
How can I catch this guy? If there's nobody on the bus, I can bus!
You can't do this alone.
Whoever did this has another motive. Something personal.
When was the last time you saw your father?
Jordan, this is Spiral, and you're the only one of us who's seen it, which is probably quite good because I think I'd be flipping terrified. But tell us, what is Spiral?
I'm the only one who's had an audience with the Jigsaw killer, so the to Jigsaw. Speak. This is the latest installment in the Saw series, the long-running Saw series. Every film to date has been centered around Tobin Bell's Jigsaw and his acolytes, but this film is a little bit different and is best described as a spin-off rather than a reboot. Chris Rock stars and actually pitched the film to Lionsgate and the producers at Twisted Pictures because he's such a big Saw fan. He plays Detective Zeke Banks, son of former police captain Marcus Banks, played by Samuel L. Jackson. Zeke is a bit of a pariah in his police department because he ratted out a dirty cop at the beginning of his career when he was just doing the beat. So when the severed pieces of dead cops start turning up on his desk, care of Jigsaw or a copycat killer, his colleagues aren't too pleased when he's chosen to lead the case alongside Max Minghella's rookie detective, William. And naturally, there are tons and tons of horrible traps where people get killed by these elaborate mechanical murder machines. I don't want to say too much more than that plot-wise, because the joy of the Saw franchise, for me at least, even more so than seeing all the inventive ways that they've come up with in order to dismember and kill horrible people, is trying to work out the kind of mystery box narrative that they've assembled. Every one of these films is a bit like a magic trick where you don't quite know what's going on and there are rug pulls left, right, and center. And that's definitely the case here as well. You'll know if you're a long-serving fan of the series as well that the Saw films around 4, 5, and 6 got incredibly dense and complicated,
yeah.
With, you know, characters constantly returning or revealing new connections and bit of backstory, twists upon twists that completely change your understanding of everything that's going on. Needlessly intricate stuff, really. Spiral strips all that back, and you don't really need to have seen a single Saw film before this, but there's plenty more that you will get out of it if you have. So the plot itself is pretty streamlined. It's as streamlined as the first Saw was. You know, for me, it was a very accomplished thriller in the mold of Seven, and this is kind of in the same way and didn't dial up the gore in the same way that future sequels would. And where the previous films were about Jigsaw testing people's will to live after some heinous act goes unpunished, the big idea here is that the killer, Jigsaw or otherwise, he's going after corrupt cops. He's essentially cleaning up the precinct where Zeke works and where the system has failed to, you know, account for these rotten apples. So there's a political relevance here that feels very of the moment in the wake of recent protests against police, especially in America and in the UK. And I don't want to spoil anything, but it's film's politics. They're not just lip service politics either. They have a huge payoff that, for me at least, lived up to the series legacy for these kind of jaw-dropping endings that leave you walking out of the cinema kind of like squinting into the sunlight and barely believing what you've just seen. Yeah,
I mean, this just sounds amazing.
I actually really liked it. I was surprised how good it was. I will caveat that by saying I love the Saw series. I think the first Saw is genuinely a horror masterpiece. The sequels ebb and flow with how good they are, but for the most part, I love them all. That said, if you're not a Saw fan, there's probably not a ton here that will convert you to Team Spiral. You know, it doesn't invent the wheel, no pun intended. It's still essentially a thriller where you occasionally watch people die in these wincingly horrible ways, like having their fingers pulled off or their tongues ripped out. With Chris Rock in the lead, there's a bit more humor here, as you might expect, than there has been in the past, certainly. You know, the original film's very po-faced, very serious, though I would hardly say it's a comedy. And when I interviewed this film's director, Darren Lynn Bousman, for the magazine, who previously directed Saws 2, 3, and 4, he said they actually took a lot of the comedy out because it was undercutting the tension. So while there is humor here, it's certainly not a horror comedy. For all the credit I gave it earlier about the fact it's, you know, saying something about the state of the world, it's not the most subtle film. Like, there's absolutely no nuance to its message. Like, its message is...
Who goes to horror films for subtlety, really? That's not what you're looking for, is it?
That is true. But, you know, horror does have a legacy of... you know, having important social messages embedded into it. You know, most recently, Jordan Peele's Get Out was an amazingly nuanced and intricate kind of portrait of post-Obama America. You know, George Romero, the zombie films, all built on these social satires. And this isn't operating on anywhere near that level, but I have to give it credit for at least trying. And for me, at least, it worked and it didn't feel exploitative. As a long-standing fan of the series, for me, this felt like a really successful reinvention and a very worthy return for a series that, you know, I have a lot of respect and time for.
Do you think they'll take it further and there's potential for more films off the back of this one? Is it reinventing it in order to continue to franchise it?
I think it's definitely possible. I think in the past, their ethos was, if this film does well, we'll do another one. There was none of the MCU style long game with it, where they were planning films like five films in advance. It was just, this film's hit number one in the box office again, let's make another. And I think if this film does well, there's every chance we will see another film set in this world. It's no spoiler to say that, as I mentioned at the beginning, this is a spin-off. It's not a reboot. It's basically a continuation of what's come before. And so it doesn't overwrite anything that's come before. And again, when I spoke to the film's director, Darren Lynn Bousman, he was quite clear that whether or not we see Tobin Bell return as Jigsaw in this film, he's very confident that we will see another film with Jigsaw, whether it's this one or another one in the future. So I'm very confident that this won't be the end for the Saw series. And I'm quite glad for that, because I think these films occupy a space that few films do now. You know, they were part of that torture porn quote unquote wave in the early noughties, all throughout the noughties. It's a little unfair to label the Saw films as torture porn for me, because I think there's a bit more to them than something like, you know, Hostel or Captive or all those films. I'm glad that people are starting to recognize that there's a bit more to Saw as a series, and that you can do very interesting things like they have done with Spiral.
It also sounds like it's a film you want to see in the cinema. I mean, like, Jamie, you're a big horror fan. Seeing films, scary films with other people and sort of feeding off their energy is what you want, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I go both ways with horror films, in terms of it can be wonderful watching them at home alone because you can control your environment. So what I do is I turn off all the lights. I watch them late at night when it's kind of silent all around, and I really maximize the potential to give it every chance to terrify me. But equally, it's wonderful to go to a cinema and, like you said, feed off it. Because if a horror film works and it's good and it's playing well, you can feel it in the room, that everyone's clenched. They're all going into the fetal position. They kind of all gasp at the same moment. And that just sort of adds to the fear, but it just sort of escalates. So it can be absolutely wonderful. I can remember watching Hereditary in the cinema, and that moment where, you know, the bit on the wall, as it were, for, I don't want to give too much away for people who haven't seen it, but there's
upper wall.
Yeah, upper wall. And there's one bit where just everyone, you know, they all kind of spotted it at slightly different times, but this tidal wave, this sort of Mexican wave of little yelps and screams went around the cinema. So it can be great, but I'm very glad to hear what Jordan's saying, because I've been trying to get a link for Spiral all week and it hasn't been forthcoming yet. They've promised it for me tonight, so hopefully I'll watch it tonight. But normally when that happens, it means, you know, a film can be a bit dodgy. They don't want you to see it. So the fact Jordan is singing its praises means my viewing tonight could be pleasurable.
or just absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
I made this point in my review for Total Film, my 4-star review for Total Film. But as you say, Jamie, this is such a film you want to see with an audience in a cinema. I remember I saw the first Saw film back in 2004 when I was 18. The first film I saw when I went to university for some reason. And I remember watching that film with an audience and that ending, that absolutely incredible Tobin Bell gets up off the floor ending, game over ending. It's just absolutely incredible. And the one thing that I'm a little bit sad about, you know, because I watched this film on a link by myself in my house, is that I didn't get to experience it with other people sat around me, which I just know would have been absolutely incredible, even with, you know, social distancing and people sat five seats away from you. Like, you absolutely want that experience of watching the ending of this film for the first time with other people around you, because I guarantee you won't forget it in a hurry.
While we're here, can I just also give a quick shout out for Chris Rock, because I haven't seen him in Spiral yet, but I have seen him. I've watched the first few episodes of Fargo season 4, which he's the lead in, or one of the leads, and playing a dramatic role. You know, he's more renowned for his comedy, although he does do drama, and he's really good in Fargo season 4, which is now on Channel 4. So I'm just going to sort of wave my arms in the air and say to everyone, hey, if you want something good to watch, you know, go to Channel 4, watch Fargo season 4. So far, it's very good, and Chris Rock's great in it.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. That was the president of the Chris Rock fan club speaking there.
That was a president of Channel 4 as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that is Spiral, and that is out when, Jordan?
That's out Monday the 17th.
So yes, go see that and frighten yourself stupid. Okay, so that's all we have time for this week. Shall we move on to our reader's question? This reader asks, as we might be starting to return to our offices, which movie office would you like to work in? Mostly when you see offices in movies, they're awful places to work, aren't they? I'm struggling to think of an office that actually might be good, because, you know, you think about Office Space or Wolf of Wall Street. They don't seem like very nice places to work. Where
the
would
assistant.
You like
the That'd assistant? Be horrible.
Oh, God, yeah. Where would you like to work? Is there somewhere you would like?
I've got a couple, actually. I was thinking about this, and there's a couple I'd like. Number one, I'd like to go back in time and work at the Wall Street Journal in All the President's Men, just because when you're growing up, you know, I wanted to be a journalist. And when you're growing up, that's exactly how you imagine a newsroom to be, that everyone in that room is kind of clacking away at their typewriters and smoking and working really hard. And they have purpose. You know, they're doing big stories and journalism's important. You know, I'd like to be embroiled in that atmosphere for a little bit, rather than at my desk on my own at home, as it is at the moment, trying to force myself to work. But the other place I'd like to be, which looks like a fun office, is the Facebook office in Social Network. Just because, you know, I've never been to Pixar. I think Jordan may have, but I know journalists who have, and they all say you walk into Pixar and it's that wonderful sort of creative environment where it's not a stressful office where people are sort of, you know, hunched over their desks and pale and grey and just all of that. It just seems so much fun, and people are just having, you know, a great time and being creative and imaginative. And the Facebook office and Social Network is a bit like that, that people just wander in at whatever time. They sort of have their coffee in their hand, they have a chat, they, like, you know, mess around for a bit. It's a bit like the Total Film office, to be honest. But yeah, that looks like fun. So those are my two choices.
I actually have a friend who works at Instagram, so I've actually been to the real Facebook offices in London. Sadly, when everyone else had gone home, but there was a pick and mix stall there where you could just get pick and mix whenever you wanted. So it's probably going to live up to the hype.
I think we should make sure that happens in the Total Film office. Mind you, that's not a very COVID secure thing, is it? Pick and mix, where everyone can put their hands in the boxes and daub their germs all over everything. I think we might have to rethink that.
We have a lot of Swedish fish, don't we, in the Total Film office?
We're going to have to portion out the Swedish fish in future, I think, into sterile bags. What about you then, Jordan?
Well, my pick was actually going to be All the President's Men as well, just out of journalistic integrity. My second choice was the office in Nakatomi Plaza in Die Hard, which I just thought would be really fun. You could just join John McClane fighting off terrorists, running around in a vest top. Trying to avoid the glass. I think it'd be great.
You're not going to see eventful. Much of the office, though, are you? You're going to be inside the air conditioning ducts most of the time.
Ventilation shaft or something.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't be bored, would you? That's the best thing about it. Like, you can't say that it's a boring 9-to-5 desk job. You're going to see a lot of the world outside of your desk. Jordan,
I would love you to do that, to be crawling around the ventilation shafts at Total Film, and I'd like to be the one who's just walking around shooting at you.
Well, I don't know what that says. Just to be clear, boys, that's not happening when we go back to the office. We're not having that.
Jordan, it is.
Yes. I'm going to throw you down the elevator shaft. Ready. If we had one.
Yeah.
My office would be the office of Griffin Mill in The Player. I would like to have one of those bungalow offices on the back lot where you park your car and then drive to the office in a golf cart. And there's like an army of soldiers walking past, or showgirls, or like circus acts, or whatever. There's just all of the people that are working on different films around you walking past your office, and you're sat in this lovely 1930s office just having a lovely time and having an assistant bring you coffee and just, you know, having a lovely time. I think that would be a very nice office. I wish I could have that.
I'm going to do some terrible name dropping now.
There we go.
I'm sure we've all done this, like being journalists and having interviews, but I've been in some amazing offices in my time. That I've been in Scorsese's office, in Aritu's office. Robert Altman, I went into his office. The whole interview was cleaning his ears with an earbud as I spoke to him. And he was just getting really in there deep, and then he kept just pulling it out and inspecting it and then putting it back in.
Oh, no.
Yeah, while we were talking about Nashville and all these great movies he's made. So that was fun. Yeah, I've been in a few offices, and yeah, if you told 16-year-old Jamie that one day being Robert Altman's office, that's why this job can be the best.
Well, on that note, let's sign off then, because I don't think it's going to get any better than that this week. Jamie having an audience with Robert Altman's earwax. Before we go, don't forget that the latest issue of Total Film is on sale now and has Suicide Squad on the cover. And it's a gatefold cover. It's double your money. More people on that cover than ever before, including a giant shark. And who doesn't love a giant shark? Always makes any film better. And I say that with great love for the Meg. So for now, shall we say goodbye?
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, God.
Kurgan's back.
Go away and come back another time. Goodbye.
Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working.